TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Hurricane Katrina and the War on the Poor. This is an archival program for the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. It's an eyewitness report that never made the national media in the detail you are about to hear now. For those stranded on the last remaining high ground, the area around the French Quarter, the only way to safety was the Greater New Orleans Bridge, crossing the Mississippi River to Gretna and Jefferson Parish. Lori Beth Slonsky and Larry Bradshaw are paramedics with the San Francisco Fire Department. They were attending a paramedics conference in the convention center. Unable to get a rental car and leave, they survived the hurricane in a 120-year-old hotel in the French Quarter. This is the story of their escape from New Orleans. During their 5-day ordeal, they experienced much kindness from ordinary people, but, with one exception, only brutal disregard from police, sheriffs, and National Guard. In fact, they were prevented at gunpoint from leaving the town on their own. 2 days after landfall of the hurricane, no help of any kind was arriving. Lori Beth and Larry helped raise $25,000 for 10 buses to pick up a large group of stranded tourists, residents, and hotel workers. Many workers had been left behind. Their employers had asked them to stay and take care of the property and the remaining guests. But now few of them offered help in getting them out. The buses never arrived. Larry told me that they did not mind that they were confiscated by the army, but he wonders why his small group succeeded in renting buses using only their cell phones, while FEMA was unable to get buses into town until 2 days later. When the hotels turned out their remaining guests and locked their doors, their group of about 200 encountered the First National Guard. The guard prevented them from going to the Superdome or convention center and told them they were on their own. They then made their way to a police command center on Canal Street and were told then there was no evacuation, no shelter, no food, or even water. The group then decided to set up camp across from the command center. Their plan was to stay together for support and to stay visible to media and rescue teams as a group in need. The police commander approached them a while later and told them there were buses waiting for them at the Greater New Orleans Bridge. As they made their way to the bridge, the only way out of the flooded town, they passed the convention center and were joined by a group of people who were trying to escape from the squalor and neglect they experienced there. Here are Lori Beth Slonsky and Larry Bradshaw.
People grabbed their families and what few belongings they had, and people had put their elderly in shopping carts, and we had strollers and babies, and we just sort of had this little ragtag group of, I don't know, 800, 1,000?
About 800 to 1,000. The streets were pretty well filled up, and this is where we determinedly marched up the on-ramp, and this is when it started to rain. It started to rain ferociously. And here we got so wet, but nonetheless, we were so excited that it doesn't matter. We're going to get to some buses. And as we approached the on-ramp,
we saw there were uniformed officers standing at the foot of the bridge, which we didn't think anything of it at first. And as we got closer, Lori Beth and I were sort of in the middle of the group, you know, trying to help some of the seniors and people that were having trouble walking. So we weren't at the front of the line. But before the front of the group even got within speaking distance, we later found out was the Gretna Sheriff's Department fired their guns over our head to stop us. And we heard all this shooting, and you were hearing gunfire on a regular basis. But to hear it so close and We just thought it was coming from some other source. We had no idea it was coming from the police. But meanwhile, our group is now scattered and sort of running in all directions. And, you know, the word's getting back to us, you know, what happened, that they're shooting at us.
And telling us we have to get off the on-ramp. We cannot go onto the on-ramp. We even held back for a while. And then after a bit, we decided to approach back up. And Larry, with his badge and our hands up, said, "May we approach?" And Larry had, they finally allowed him to approach, still with guns pointed right at us. And had, we had asked and explained, actually, that we were told by the police command center that we were supposed to, this is what our job was now, was to go to this on-ramp and pick up a bus to get out of New Orleans. And this is, he said,
told us that there were no buses across the bridge and that there were no pedestrians going to be allowed across the bridge. So we tried to probe and find, I mean, this, remember, this is a freeway, like an interstate. It's like three lanes each direction, but it's not being used. There's a little bit of emergency traffic coming in from the south to the north. But in the way that we're going, I mean, there's like a car maybe every 5 minutes. I mean, just like nobody on it. So we said, well, what's wrong with us, you know, orderly crossing the bridge? And the two comments we got from deputies were, one, we're not going to have a Superdome over here, and this is not New Orleans.
What is on the other side of that bridge? Where does it lead to?
It leads to another parish, Jefferson Parish, and Highway 90 was really the only way out of the city, that and the only way in that emergency vehicles were using to come and go.
It was on drier land, and it was where the Gretna police came from. And these were the Gretna police who told us we would not be able to cross over this bridge.
So we were sort of flabbergasted. I mean, the only way we can interpret that is sort of code words for, if you're poor, you're black, you're not getting into our neighborhood. We were all sort of shell-shocked and sort of like, you know, what do we do now? And where do we go to?
We were sopping wet, and by this time, people were very demoralized. It's like the fourth day. There's no food. There's no water. So our little group kind of came back together and said, well, we really have no choice. We have to find shelter. We can't go back to the command center. We can't go to the Superdome. We can't go to the convention center. What are we going to do? And this is when we decided that we would go to the underpass, where there was two concrete barriers that we could go in between and set up and be safe from if there were any traffic. So we regrouped and we gathered. We were about 30 or 40 people that we went to this little safe spot. And we, as a group, cleaned up the area and made it safer for the children, and we made a little area for some elderly people that were really having a hard time getting around. They were quite ill and quite slow, and many were diabetic. So we were starting to set up, and lo and behold, blessed be, this man was driving a big water truck, those big 5-gallon drums of water, and he and his wife, and they had a baby, unloaded all of the water onto our little embankment area. And once we got that unloaded, we then loaded up all as many children and as many older people that we could with their parents and family onto the water truck, and out of the city they went. That, to me, was my first vision of a real hero, someone who delivered a necessity of water to us and then took as many people as they could out of New Orleans. Once we had the water in these plastic crates, Larry and some of the kids built this really ingenious private loo, or this private bathroom, over the storm drains. And they made it so the plastic container would give you some privacy. And then behind it, they took some old broken umbrellas so you couldn't see in from behind. Then they found a piece of wood so you'd have a door that would slide open and close. And further, because by this point we still had our luggage, we had some colors and crayons, and the kids made a sign that said, you know, please keep our bathroom clean. And we had a roll of toilet paper, and we took some of the water, the 5-gallon drum of water, so people could wash their hands.
They were letting people drive across the bridge. But later, when we actually were able to cross the bridge on another day, the officials down there had every exit blocked with trucks, so that they figured, I guess, if you could drive across the bridge, you'd keep going and you wouldn't stop in their community. But I guess because we're walking, they knew they wouldn't be able to stop people from walking off the freeway and settling into their community, because it was dry ground. And there was a lot of dry ground. And most of who were with us were families. All day long, we sat there about a mile down from the entrance to the bridge, and we saw families, we saw individuals, we saw groups make their way up the incline to be turned away by the Gretna Sheriff's Department with either no, you can't cross, verbal abuse, or shooting in some cases above people's head. So there were literally thousands and thousands of New Orleanians that were prevented from rescuing themselves and getting across the bridge.
Tell me a little bit about the people who were with you.
Well, it started out, we'd say, about 30 or 40 people, but once we got some water and also up the road a bit, we saw, I think it was a National Guard truck, kind of quickly take a turn, and some sea rations fell out. And so Larry and some other folks, we commandeered some folks to go get those sea rations and bring them back. So you ask who is in our group. Our group grew. Our group grew to about 90 or 100 people. Every time we saw someone walking, we'd say, hey, come over here. Do you need water? Do you need food? And I can assure you that many people came up. So our group grew from this, like I said, 80 or 90 people. So many absolutely adorable children that were so keen on setting up garbage cans on the rebar pipe. They made a little garbage area. They set up a little recycling area to take whatever food one group wasn't eating, to applesauce for a baby that was in another family down a couple of feet.
The people in our encampment were all local New Orleanians. Again, mostly families that were looking.
African American. I would say that most everybody was African American except for three out of our group and a couple of other working class families from New Orleans, but mostly African American folks.
So what happened to your camp? Your beautiful camp?
We felt like this was a sort of a good option. We're up in an elevated freeway, so we've got security. We can see everything coming in. One of the tasks we gave the kids was to count the buses. Now we were seeing buses for the first time. And we knew there was like 20,000 people at the Superdome, which we were a few blocks away from. So we were counting the buses, figuring 50 people per bus. You know, we were going to count 20,000 people, and then we, you know, would make our way down to take our turn to go on the buses. And we had food and water. So we felt, you know, that we would take care of ourselves, and we could wait this out for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days, whatever it took. One older woman had a little portable radio up to her ear. And the batteries were very low, and she came sort of almost dancing over excitedly, saying, they're talking about us. They're talking about us on the radio. People are saying, what are you going to do about all those families up on the interstate? And big cheer went up, and the officials had said, don't worry, we'll take care of them. Now, Lori Beth and I talked, and that sounded kind of ominous to me, and I was kind of worried that they would come and try to move us off the freeway. But the majority sentiment was very positive and felt like, okay, by remaining visible, you know, we were going to get some help. Mm. So the sun finally came out right before it set over the horizon, and we were, you know, taking off our shoes and trying to dry off a little bit. And just as it got dusk, Gretna Sheriff pulled up by himself, jumped out of the car with his gun aimed right at us, and was just screaming, just frantically screaming, get off the fucking freeway, get off the fucking freeway, get out of here, just pointing the gun at people's face and just creating pandemonium and just scaring the hell out of all of us. I mean, he didn't shoot at us, but we were more scared of him than we were when we were being shot at. He just looked like he had lost it. He was crazed. So people are slowly backing down, sort of backing off, trying to figure out what to do, and people are leaving their belongings behind. And then a helicopter comes down and uses the wind from its blades to start blowing sort of all the stuff that we had built, you know, our beds and the car. It's all cardboard and plastic, so of course it just blows away. And then as we sort of back away, the sheriff starts loading up the food and water in his car. So we were all pretty dispirited and demoralized, and now it's dark.
And it's martial law. Then we have been told repeatedly that it was martial law and it was a shoot to kill policy. Fortunately, one of the women in our group had little eagle eyes, and she was just scouting out the area as we had scattered away from this crazed looking sheriff. And she spotted a little yellow school bus that was inside a church area. So we made our way down, and we got to the church area, and we had one of the limber kids manage to get into the window. There was a broken window. We didn't break it. It had already been broken, and we took cover there because we heard all you could hear was sirens and helicopters and shooting. You didn't know if it was from the police or for looters, but all we knew was that we needed to take cover, and we did. And that is where, with our sinking hearts from top to bottom, we waited out the night with the bugs and the mosquitoes and the hot and humid, and just laid as low as we possibly could till the early morning hours came.
Hiding from those who were supposed to help you.
Yes, all the rumors were, you know, the violence and gangs and looters. I'm not saying that that wasn't going on. We didn't have any trouble from anybody on the street. Our trouble was always law enforcement, in particular the Gretna Sheriff's Department. You know, we can only speculate, but it certainly seems like racism was what was at play here.
So when is the first time you actually saw an official national effort to help you?
Well, Thursday, we noticed some supplies and buses and more rescue vehicles coming into the city. Still pretty sparse. By Friday, you know, Thursday night, we could hear them coming over the bridge all night while we're sleeping in the bus. And by Friday, you know, it seemed like the pace was picking up. We fortunately were able to make contact with the New Orleans Fire Department on Friday, and our fortunes changed dramatically after that.
They recognized you as a fellow paramedic with the fire department?
Yes. If I wasn't a paramedic in the fire department, we would not have been given the treatment that allowed us, our group of eight, to get safety and to get picked up by helicopters and moved out.
Where did the helicopters take you?
The helicopters took us actually to a National Guard. And this is where two National Guard let us come into their truck, and they were going to take us to the airport. And they were, I have to say, two very kind gentlemen. They made big apologies that Louisiana State wasn't giving us food and water and resources weren't coming. And they felt that it was because so much of the resources from the National Guard were, in fact, in Iraq. They were very generous to us, though. They said, we do have some water. Here's some sea rations. Please take this. So they took us to the airport, but we were not allowed to get out of the truck because apparently Bush, that would be President Bush, was there. I could only call it a photo op because we never saw him. And they had to drive us away, and we had to go through a much more bureaucracy. And this is where we were dropped off. No resources whatsoever. And we heard later from officials that there were probably about 6,000 people that were at the airport in this little teeny tiny area, just mushed together, waiting to get out.
When you were in this cage area at the airport, were you given food at least and water?
No, we were not given food and water. I did see a couple of sandwiches going by, but I don't know where or who that came from. And not only that, we still had some of our sea rations. And once we were pushed into this area where we ultimately did get lifted out, they took away our sea rations because they said that it set off the metal detectors. So now, once again, our food was taken away if we wanted to get transported out. And once we got past the metal detectors, and by this point, most everybody we saw had no luggage, or maybe they had a plastic bag, or they had a hospital gown on, or they were just covered in their own feces, if not somebody else's, that were were trying to go board a plane. We were delayed for hours and hours, according to one of the workers there, because of Bush, the security that went around looking after Bush.
I have to say, the first people that treated us with any sort of dignity and respect were the TSA, mm-hmm. you know, the security people at the airport. Mm-hmm. They were the first ones that talked to us, not yell at us, and that treated us with humanity. It's really changed my attitude towards the TSA.
I mean, as a matter of fact, two of the TSA women went beyond the call of duty, and that there was woman, as I'm referring to, that was had her own feces all over her. I went to the bathroom to help clean this woman up, and this is where you get hope in the world, is not only were these two women willing and able to help me clean up this lady, older lady, but someone else had a Depends, and someone else had a new pair of clean pair of clothing, and we were able to get this woman ready for the next journey.
Did you have a choice as to where you were taken?
The majority of the aircraft were going to go to San Antonio, but we were told that you wouldn't know for sure until you got on the actual plane, and then you'd be told where you were going to. But at this point, none of us cared. As long as we got out, you know, we didn't care where you took us to at this point.
We went to San Antonio, and once we got to San Antonio, which is a couple of hours later, this is where I, again, had the most horrible sinking feeling. Once we arrived and deboarded the plane, there we had to put whatever minimal belongings we had down on the ground late at night for dog to sniff our belongings, two different sets of dogs. What they were looking for, I don't know. I only feel sorry for dogs because I think we smelled worse than dogs' butt.
From there, we were put on buses. We thought we were landing at the San Antonio Airport, but we didn't. We landed at Lackland Air Force Base, and they were converting a former Army base right next door into a shelter. So it's like a five-minute ride. But they were so inundated and so behind that we pulled into this parking lot with another, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 buses full of people. Some of them had air conditioning, some of them didn't. And we just sat waiting for, you know, to be processed. And remember, the kids hadn't eaten anything all day. The only restroom facilities were two porta potties in this parking lot that were overflowing and filthy, and no light, no food for anybody, and just went on for hours and hours and hours. And finally, Lori Beth and the two kids that were with us took the initiative, and they went out and just demanded, "Are we under arrest?" And the multiple police jurisdictions were there, and they said, "No, you're not under arrest." And we said, "Well, we can leave, right?" And they said, "Well, we prefer you don't leave. We need to process you." And we tried to keep explaining, "We don't need to be processed. We have a home. We have airline tickets. We just need a cab or an airport. We'll walk, whatever it takes. We don't need housing or shelter." They said, "Well, we really prefer you stay. You may have a communicable disease." And this is when they started referring to us as refugees, which was sort of very strange to have someone calling you a refugee. It's sort of a moniker that Americans aren't used to having attached to us. So finally, we just said, "If we're not under arrest, we're leaving." And our group of eight just walked away. And we had a home to go to. The majority of people that were with us had no place to go. They had no choice. So we don't know how many hours they waited in the buses to finally get processed, finally get a shower, finally get a meal. But I have to contrast sort of the official treatment to the treatment we got from ordinary Texans. Once they found out we were from New Orleans and that we had gotten out, people were just so generous. I mean, we seen an airport worker take off her shoes and give it to a person who was homeless. People were offering us money. People were offering us toiletries.
There was another lady at the airport who had a baby and had nothing but the Pampers on the baby. And some woman just gave her every bit of things that she had from her well child, clothes, the little carrier case, all the Pampers, gave her everything that she had in herself. It just showed us the generosity and the possibility and creativity and loving that people will give and share with each other if they're allowed to.
The real heroes in our eyes were the people who worked in the French Quarter in downtown New Orleans. Many of them were asked to stay by their employers, and we just saw really the only relief effort for the first 3 or 4 or 5 days were the people who worked in New Orleans. And we saw mechanics just doing amazing things with generators, keeping them running, coaxing them, fixing elevator motors so that people could, you know, move up and down, that had mobility problems. We saw refinery workers who stole boats, you know, to go rescue their neighbors and then rescue strangers. The food service workers, you know, were just amazing. They continued to serve communal meals for days after the hurricane, just scraping together anything they could. I mean, we served it small portions to make sure it went around to everybody. But those are the real heroes and sheroes in our mind, were, you know, the people that really sort of kept us alive and kept us going for the first 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm. We need to focus on how to get people the basic things that we need in life: food, water, shelter. And I believe from there, all sorts of creativity and caring can happen. So the one other thing I keep thinking of is, now that we're not refugees, we are evacuees. So now we have a lot of homeless people who are evacuees, but we also have a huge amount of people who are homeless and without health care insurance. And instead of dividing, which I can see happening already, to split and divide people, we need to just provide care to anybody who needs it. And by providing care to anybody who needs it, we will have a healthier, stronger America.
But thank you for sharing our story. And I think that if we hadn't been there, it would have been hard for us to fathom how inept and how callous and how racist the relief effort was if we didn't see it with our own eyes. Mm-hmm. So thank you for helping share that information.
Yes, thank you.
You heard from Lori Beth Slonsky and Larry Bradshaw. They are paramedics and found themselves stranded in New Orleans after attending a professional conference just before Hurricane Katrina hit the town. I found their report on the internet and was moved to look for them, thanks to the Service Employees International Union, of which they are members. I found them just 10 minutes south of TUC Radio Studio. This was an archival program first broadcast in early September 2005. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.